Earlier this month, the Argentinian naval training vessel, the Libertad, sailed into Dublin as part of its 160-day training voyage, visiting 10 countries around the world. While the vessel was at Sir John Rogerson's Quay in Dublin, the crew visited Foxford in County Mayo, the birthplace of the father of the Argentinian Navy, Irishman Admiral William Brown. Noel Sweeney went along to the Libertad for seascapes, where he was welcomed aboard by the ship's crew and the captain.
Earlier this month, the Argentinian Navy's tall ship, the Libertad, pulled into Sir John Rogerson's Quay in Dublin's Docklands, where she was met by Argentine officials. And as the vessel approached for berthing, I met with Argentina's ambassador to Ireland, Laura Bernal.
Hello, good morning. My name is Laura Bernal. I'm the ambassador of Argentina to Ireland. I represent the Argentine government here in Ireland. And I'm really happy to be here because we have a lot of links between our two countries. Admiral Brown, who was the founder of our Navy, he was an Irishman and he fought for our independence. So you must be very, very proud of it.
Absolutely. And how do you feel being here today?
Oh, it's wonderful. When I arrived here in 2016, we have the visit of the Fragata Ara Libertad. And now, this year, it's coming again, and it's wonderful. We are going to visit Foxford, the land of Admiral Brown, next Sunday with 200 members of the crew, and it will be so touching. Every year that we go to Foxford, it's so nice, so touching that we can't believe it.
And what's the occasion on this time? Because I know the last time it was celebrating 200 years of independence.
Yes, so this but it's the annual trip for the crew. Mm-hmm. They usually, not every year, comes to Ireland, but we are lucky this year to have it again.
203 years.
Yeah, 203 years of our independence. Thank you so much.
I was then greeted on board by two of our crew, Emilio and Cacciano.
My name is Emiliano Santiago. I'm a lieutenant. I'm in charge with all relative with the main deck. The most important thing to say, first of all, this is our symbol, our embassy on the seas. And well, it's an honor for us to go to every port showing our flag. We have 3 sticks, but with 27 sails.
Wow.
Yeah, we have 15 like square sails, yeah. Then we have 9 triangle like this, and we have 5 more in the bow. And all the sails, it's about 2,600 square meters of sails.
Can you tell us what the students learn while they're on the vessel?
Yeah, the vessel is a training ship. Our career, it's about 5 years. 4 of them, of those, we are in the Naval Academy, and the last year of that course, the 5th year, we come on board of the Fragata Libertad, the tall ship Libertad, just in order to put in practice all the knowledge that we achieved during the Naval Academy. Every oceans and seas, just to know our midshipmen, how is the way to sail in different parts of the world, but because you know that in different countries we have, for example, different kind of signals.
You've obviously traveled thousands upon thousands of miles. Yeah. What kind of weather have you guys endured?
The ship is a vessel, so we use the wind to sail. So the bad weather or the good weather for us is the same. The only bad condition for us is not windy. So we can use the sails. So when we have, for example, bad weather, we reduce the speed or we can put more or less amount of sails.
I'm Lieutenant Cagiano Blanco.
Where have you come from before you arrived into Dublin this morning?
From London.
That's not very far away now, so you surely come farther than that.
Well, the first port was Salvador de Bahia in Brazil. Then we came here to Europe, to Spain, Cádiz, Santa Cruz de Tenerife. Then we went to Lisboa, Brest, and Amberes. I don't know how to say Amberes in English. Belgium,
oh.
And then London, and then here.
And where are you off to next?
We're heading to Boston, and then to Miami, Barbados, and then Brazil again, Uruguay, and Argentina. 5 months and a half. This is my first year. I'm a lawyer.
Are you working as a lawyer on the vessel?
Yes, I'm in charge of the public relations of the vessel, and I'm a lawyer. I cannot be a lawyer, so I, just in case. In Argentina, I am a lawyer. I have trials and everything like that. And here, I am in charge of the public relations. I prepare the presents.
Emilio led me below deck, where I got to meet the Libertad's captain, Juan Carlos Romay.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Captain Juan Carlos Romay, commanding officer of our training ship, Frigate Ara Libertad, of the Argentine Navy. We are very glad of arriving today to Ireland. We are very happy. We have a lot of expectations because it's the birthplace of our naval hero, Admiral Brown. So for all the crew, it's very important to be here to know his birthplace in Fort Ford. This is the 48th training cruise, and her mission is to perform the nautical skills of the future naval officers. We have a program in the Naval Academy of 4 years, and in the 5th year, they come on board and they have to train all the nautical skills and also perform their duties on all the different departments and organizations of the ship, being the most real of the job that they will perform when they will be graduated as officers in the other ships of the Navy. We have been traveling since August 17, when we left Argentina, Buenos Aires. The ship began her construction in 1953. And was finished in 1962. The hull is from iron, and we have the deck is in wood. It's a special wood that is they bring from India because it's very tough, very hard. And it has the record of crossing the North Atlantic by sail in 1966. When she crossed from Canada to Ireland. Then I can show you beside the door there is the medal which reflects this record. Also, there is another kind of prize that is called the Boston Teapot that is given by the International Sailing Association to the ship which has at least 50% of the people on training, and it covers only by sail the maximum distance in a period of 124 hours. So this prize, the Frigate Libertad won it in 9 opportunities. This is the prize, the Boston Teapot.
How long have you been captain?
We are only 1 year captains of the ship. Only around 30% of the crew stays for a second year.
Any plans to stay for a second year?
Say again?
any chance for a stay?
Unfortunately, no. I don't think so.
Noel Sweeney on board the Libertad. Edward Bransfield is a pioneering Irish navigator who was the leader of the first expedition to see and chart the Antarctic mainland. He is to be commemorated in this country for the very first time on January 25th, when a memorial to him is unveiled in his native Ballinacurra in County Cork. Jim Wilson is the chairman of the Remembering Edward Bransfield Commemoration Committee, and he came into studio to tell me about this remarkable man.
He was born and raised in Ballinacurra in Cork Harbour, on the shores of Cork Harbour. And it was the outbreak of the Napoleonic Wars. He was out, we reckon, fishing, and the Royal Navy, they needed a lot of men for this war, up to 100,000. And one way of getting them was literally plucking them from small boats and on shore and forcing them into service. And this is what happened to Edward Bransfield at the age of 18. That would have been June 2nd, 1803.
What was called a press gang. It's a term we still use today.
That's correct. It has become part of the English language. It basically means a group of men who are going to take individuals, usually young, able-bodied men, and actually literally carry them off to join the Navy. So they had no say in it, these poor unfortunates, and Edward Bransfield was one of those. And they would go around. There's very famous, the extreme sort of examples of going into taverns and bars late at night and hauling people off, banging them over the head, and the next thing they wake up in the morning and they're on a sailing ship heading for France. You know, that's the kind of classic description of a press gang and how they operate.
Did you have any way of getting out of that if you found yourself on a ship?
Not once you found yourself on a ship that I'm aware of. Once you were there, you were definitely, that was it. You had no choice. But you must remember as well, this time in Ireland and Britain and all of Europe, the early 1800s, people were very poor. And conditions in life were not easy. So we reckon Edward, like an awful lot of those who were forced into the Navy, once they got there, they kind of accepted it as, you know, as a kind of a just something that happens in life, and settled in and made the best of it. They were being fed, they were being looked after. And of course, back then, the mindset was adventure was a great way of escaping the humdrum life of poverty and uncertainty.
Where did he turn up next?
So he ends up on the Ville de Paris, 110-gun warship. He rises through the ranks pretty quickly. The Napoleonic Wars end in 1815, by which time, and this is 12 years after he was forced into it, he's a master. After the Napoleonic Wars, the vast majority of these men that were press ganged were literally just dumped back onto the piers. They held on to people like Bransfield because he was very valuable. He knew how to operate a ship. He knew how to, you know, basically drive the ship, make it sail, make it go in any conditions, anywhere. 1817, he writes a letter to the Admiralty. He's currently laid off on half pay. They don't get rid of him because they want him on standby. So he's on half pay. 1817, he writes a letter, which we have, to the Admiralty, basically saying, I'm bored to tears sitting around here on land. I want nautical pursuits. I want to be active. And I've got a theory about calculating longitude that I've noticed is not being used in the Navy and is a very good backup to using the chronometers, which were sort of navigational tools.
Essentially a watch.
Exactly. Essentially a watch that you can take on a ship and it can be chucked around and it keeps time perfectly. And you need to know how to keep time to calculate longitude. But he had another way of doing it, a kind of a quick reckoner that didn't need a chronometer. And he noticed in all his years in the Navy that they weren't using it. And he wanted to go and test this. And he actually says in the letter, I want to go on a voyage of discovery. And if you can put me on that as a master, I can prove it. He ends up 2 months later, coincidentally, leapfrogging a whole pile of other very experienced masters in the Royal Navy, and is put on a ship called the Andromache, which is going to Valparaiso in Chile, where the British have a base. He ends up there, 1817. 2 years later, a guy from Northumberland in England called William Smith was rounding Cape Horn, 28-year-old, captain of a merchant ship at 28, this guy was, and he goes south of Cape Horn looking for wind, where there's nothing on the map, nothing on any map in the world that is definite beyond Cape Horn. And he finds land. He goes to the British in Valparaiso. They don't believe him in February 1819. He goes back and he tries a second time, doesn't make it. Goes back a third time, he makes it. Comes back to Valparaiso and he says, look, there's the proof. I've got all the readings. There's land down there. So Captain Shereff, who's Bransfield's boss, says, we better check this out. So what does he do? He hires William Smith's brig, the Williams, and he puts Bransfield in charge. So at 1819, Bransfield is master and commander of a ship. And in his orders, which we have, he's told, go on a voyage of discovery towards the South Pole. So he's not on any old mission. He's specifically on an expedition to explore lands towards the South Pole. And that's exactly what he does. It's considered one of the scariest places to be. And I've worked in those waters for the past 12 years. Every Irish winter, I go down on the southern summer and I show people the wildlife of Antarctica, following in the wake of Bransfield. And I've crossed it when it was flat calm, but I've also crossed it with 16 metre swell on the beam. It's not comfortable. It is a scary place. And they were in a tiny ship. It was 81 feet long. There was 30 of them on it.
So he went down, he went past the South Shetland Islands down there, and he made his discovery.
He did. He first of all confirmed William Smith's discovery of the South Shetland Islands. And on the 30th of January, 1820, 200 years ago next January, he becomes the leader of the first expedition to actually see the Antarctic mainland. They see mountains, they see Hyde, what they call rude ranges, which are kind of massive ranges covered in snow and ice. And they actually, in a diary, we've only one first-hand account left by the midshipman, who'd be the second in command. And he said that they started discussing the possibility that they had discovered the long sought after southern continent.
What happened to him after that?
He comes back, brings everyone back alive. They don't get stuck. There's no tragedy. There's no drama that is written down anyway. And he comes back and he hands over his logbook. He hands over his charts. He hands over everything to the British Admiralty. In the letter, when he's handing it over, he says, "I want to go back and finish the job." He doesn't get a chance. There is no record of him being offered a chance to go back. He leaves the Navy on half pay. He leaves the Navy on half pay about a year later. And it's a real puzzle. Most seamen who would have done what he did would have been promoted. They would have been promoted to the upper ranks as a captain. He isn't, for some reason. Some suggest it's because he was Irish. Some suggest he was Catholic. We know that his family was Catholic, but it's quite possible he changed religion. We're not sure. So he disappears. He turns up in the Merchant Navy a few times. We know of at least four ships that he sailed on. And back to South America he went a few times. He settles in Brighton and he dies in 1851 at the age of 67. His grave is reasonably good. He must have been pretty comfortable. He did some investment afterwards. He was shares in ships and stuff like that, we know. Dies reasonably comfortably, but no heir. He married three times. We reckon the first two wives died in childbirth. No heir, so no family to carry on his memory. Didn't write any books about his exploits. He disappeared. He literally sank without trace in the annals of polar exploration.
You're going to commemorate him next month.
We surely are. We've been working very hard. We're the Remembering Edward Bransfield Committee, based in Ballinacurra, and a small group of us have been doing a lot of work to raise the profile of Edward Bransfield, but also put up a monument. It's the shape of a beacon. Your listeners would probably be aware of these stone beacons, like the one at the entrance to Baltimore Harbour. And we're putting the lettering on it, and we have the sexton, and we have a penguin, and we have his ship all carved on this stone. And we will be unveiling it on the 25th of January, just 5 days before the 30th, when it was the 200th anniversary, because it's a Saturday, it's the 25th. So we're doing it then in Ballinacurra at 2 o'clock. And we will finally, as I say, mark in his hometown this great, great forgotten Antarctic explorer for sure.
Thanks to Jim Wilson of the Remembering Edward Bransfield Group. And you can get more information about that commemoration and Bransfield himself on rememberingedwardbransfield.ie. It's on the web and on Facebook. Next week on the programme, we'll be marking the 100th anniversary of Baltimore Lifeboat in County Cork. But this week, our regular contributor, Hugh Oram, has been looking at the RNLI itself.
For any maritime organisation, looking ahead to what the next decade will bring is a great challenge, but particularly with the RNLI, where unpredictability can be as much of a hazard as the next storm at sea. The RNLI is a remarkable life-saving operation, one that's been developing strongly ever since 1824, close on 200 years ago. Although it was founded in England, it began its life-saving operations here in Ireland just 2 years later when the Arklow station started. Today it has a total of 46 lifeboat stations throughout the island of Ireland. Just under a quarter are in the north of Ireland, while the remainder cover the coast of the Republic. Much depends on volunteer crews and keeping people recruited to adequately man the lifeboats around the Irish coast will of course be one of the main priorities for the RNLI in the decade ahead. Another major challenge will be keeping the funds flowing. Much depends on continuous fundraising throughout Ireland, and while people here are unremitting in their generosity to the cause of the lifeboats, challenges remain. At the moment, the RNLI is dealing with a major challenge in the form of shortfalls in its funding. The organisation has a new chief executive, Mark Dowie, a former naval officer who was appointed earlier in 2019, along with new directors. According to Niamh Stevenson, who's in charge of media operations for the RNLI in both Ireland and the Isle of Man, a lot of work is going on at the moment to secure the organisation and make it future-proof. Perhaps the biggest challenge is a shortfall in funds. At the moment, there are plans to reduce staff numbers by about 135, with most of the redundancies likely at the RNLI Support Centre in Poole. And as Dowie says, they have to take action now if the RNLI is to weather the storm. So fundraising is likely to be an ongoing concern for the next decade. And one of the challenges is that financial technology is changing so fast. People are having to adapt to many changes in an increasingly cashless society. And no doubt over the next decade, the RNLI will find new and advanced means of encouraging donations using technologies that are as yet undreamed of. The RNLI also has to continue its lifeboat production. During 2019, it built 6 more Shannon-class lifeboats at its all-weather centre in Poole, where the organisation is also spending more on refits and modifications to existing boats. The RNLI is also planning to build many more new inshore boats, as well as refitting even more at its lifeboat centre on the Isle of Wight. New materials and boat-building techniques will be very much on the menu. So over the next decade, we can expect a lot of changes to the lifeboat fleet here in Ireland. But the organisation will also be looking at whether there are sufficient lifeboat stations or whether yet more new ones will have to be built. Another big cost for the RNLI is maintaining its huge stock of spare parts, which is a very expensive item in its budget. The RNLI is now looking at the benefits of additive manufacturing, creating parts to order from digital blueprints. Making spare parts this way can be both cheaper and quicker, so over the next decade, expect lots of change in the way the RNLI handles its spare parts requirements. Increased use of renewable energy sources is another item for the future that's very much under consideration, using, for example, photovoltaic cells. But ultimately, the RNLI depends on the people who serve on its lifeboats. It wants to attract a greater diversity of people to its ranks, including women, LGBT people and young professionals, so this will be an ongoing process here in Ireland over the next decade. The RNLI also has a remarkable brand reputation to protect, one that ensures that it's one of the most trusted and responsible charities around. So much work will be ongoing to ensure that this reputation is enhanced even further during the next decade. In the maritime sphere, it's often hard to predict what's going to happen in the next few hours with so many weather variations, but the RNLI is working hard to make sure it stays totally on top of its rescue operations for the decade ahead. A big challenge indeed.
Hugh Oram.
A word about an event in Dublin tomorrow you might want to get along to. The Old and Row Group will have 14 rowing boats and an RNLI lifeboat in Dublin City Centre to raise funds for the RNLI and undersea rescue. All the boats will gather at the Sean O'Casey footbridge at 1 o'clock for a wreath-laying ceremony by the Lord Mayor, Paul McAuliffe.